Hi, I'm Phil Palucha from Billionaires in Boxers, and you are about to enjoy an interview hosted by one of our guest hosts, Andrew Tallant. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Confessions of a Successful Leader, hosted by me, Andrew Tallant, the self-coaching expert. In each episode of the show, we hear the insightful confessions of a successful leader who wants to inspire others to live their professional and personal dreams. I am always keen to hear your feedback, particularly in relation to the kinds of leaders you would like me to invite onto the show in future. But for now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the rich insights from our special guest. Hello and welcome to another episode of Confessions of a Successful Leader, hosted by me, Andrew Tallant, the self-coaching expert. This is the show where we hear the insightful confessions of a successful leader who wants to inspire others to live their professional and personal dreams. I'm delighted that Kevin Chapman has joined us today in the studio. Kevin is a highly experienced coach, consultant, trainer, communication specialist, and business leader with significant commercial experience designing and delivering leadership and high-performance coaching. He has worked with clients including Mars, BP, Coors, Shell, HSBC, PwC, and Jaguar Land Rover. A lover of the power of humour, as you will see today, storytelling and the neurochemistry of the body, he is valued for his expertise in storytelling, narrative leadership, performance and change management, becoming a trusted advisor for leaders and leadership teams to manage through difficult periods of change or improve business reputation and performance. He has a deep interest in working with the full and untapped technology of the body, and as a result, co-founded and leads the Physical Intelligence Institute. His previous role at RADA deeply sparked his interest in the body, where he led a market-leading performance brand specializing in public speaking and communication skills, and met his co-founder, Claire Dale. Kevin holds a degree in mathematical statistics and operations research, as I do, from Exeter University, and an MBA, and is qualified coach. He's also a trustee of the Comedy School and supporter of the Forgiveness Project and the Beyond Food Foundation. Kevin, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the show.
Thank you. What a wonderful introduction. We should hang out more when I go meet people.
Absolutely. And it's funny, it's funny that we did the same degree. I didn't do it at Exeter, but I did it in Salford, which is a little bit different, but it's exactly the same degree as you, which is lovely. So the audience obviously would like to get to know you a little bit. So just in your own words, just tell us a little bit about yourself and your current focus.
Sure. Well, I mean, when I tell people I did my degree in statistics, I don't really get much of a response. but despite having done that, I mean, the confession is I didn't really enjoy maths at university. I wasn't very good at it. In fact, I wasn't very good at studying at all. It sounds like I've got a resume full of all sorts of academic successes, but I'd say I was a bit of a failure at school and university. But I ended up going into consulting. I spent my life in consulting and coaching. Trained three times as a coach with different people in different ways. I've spent my life helping leaders and organizations basically change things. Some things good, some things not so good. So I learned a lot about people and business and decided to partner with a few charities that are sort of passion of mine. So really interesting comedy. I think if I had a brand, it would be Serious Fun. Sort of contradictory words coming together. I've blended working in big consultancies and then leaving those and doing my own thing and collaborating with like-minded people trying to find interesting work that makes a difference where I can learn and grow and enjoy life, because I think that's the kind of purpose and the journey that we're all on. And my current focus is what is really now known as a very important intelligence to the world, which is physical intelligence, which is really understanding that we have so much more capability beyond just our head and our minds to really deal with the very difficult concerns in life at the moment. So managing our anxiety and our stress and our confidence and our motivation. And the body is an amazing untapped source of performance for us all. And so part of my mission is bringing that into the hands of everybody, not just in professional life, but in in all aspects of the world. That sounds quite serious, doesn't it? But there's some fun in there somewhere, I promise you.
Absolutely, it's the balance. It's the balance, isn't it, again? And if I was to bump into you, you know, in the pub or the park, and I didn't really know what you did in terms of a business, obviously you've got the comedy that you're passionate about, but what other things would come up in terms of our discussion about where you spend your time outside of work?
Outside of work? Yeah, my outside interests are really supporting those three charities. So I'm very interested in, I guess the thing I'm most interested in is giving people kind of hope and shining a light on possibilities. I think when you've trained as a coach, you suddenly have this magical toolkit where you can see patterns in people and things people say and the way they behave. And I think it's a little bit of a gift to be able to offer maybe just some clarity to someone, some provocation or some support. And so a lot of my spare time I seem to bump into people and help them on their journeys. I love playing music. I think if I'd done my life again, I would have either been a musician. I've been asked many times, what would it be your ideal job or vocation in life? And it's definitely would have been half of one part of Anton Deck. In fact, I think when Deck went off, I actually had a serious moment where I thought, maybe I could apply. My middle name is Anthony, so we could have been maybe Anthony Squared or something. But I think there's a kind of theme in my life about kind of messing about and the power of messing about and holding things lightly and being be playful with good intent. I think when I was young, I had less good intent in my actions. But to shine light on things, be playful, play music and explore things like comedy. That's kind of what I tend to do. And I try and keep in shape and I play a lot with wearable tech and biohacking and some other crazy stuff as well. All really for my own amusement, if I have to be honest, mostly for my own amusement.
Well, thank you. What a great introduction to yourself. And it was interesting when we last spoke, because of the work that you do, I went to do a bit of research myself. And for some reason, I came across the book. Is it The Myth of Normal by Gabor Mate? I don't know if you've started reading that yet. And what I'm intrigued by with his work and his studies is this, how trauma that we're not really aware of, and everybody has trauma of some sort, either generational trauma or our own trauma in our own lives, and how that informs how we feel about our body and how that affects us in our relationships and indeed the way that we perform in various ways around that. So it really reiterated to me about this connection from what we can learn from what happened in our childhood to how that shapes our leadership style, how we show up in relationships generally. I just really appreciate your sort of take on that from your own experience.
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, our history is in our bodies. And if you look at all of the embodiment work, every thought, every memory, every experience is literally chemically encoded into us. Yeah. All the good ones and all the bad ones as well. So it was interesting when you were asking about, you know, going back to my child and thinking, wow, what are the memories that really first come to mind? And they're all pretty positive memories, actually. And, you know, early memories are things like putting my hand up and being part of the school play. I was Peter Rabbit in the school play with no training or skill. And then I think I played Wackford Squeers in Smike. And I do remember how much fun it was to be on stage and be watched by an audience. And also those memorable moments when things go wrong. I remember when I was Peter Rabbit, I think I had to take my jacket off halfway through the scene and my gloves were too big so my jacket wouldn't come off. And this is this amazing experience of firstly sheer terror because it's not going as it should do, followed by some irreverent improvisation and being able to let go. And I found I had a sort of natural ability to go, well, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. I think when we were playing in Smike, the lead fell over and bumped her head and got concussed and we all had to read her lines on stage, much to our amusement. So that was good. But my real interest was when I was young was playing music. And we're talking about leadership and impact, but probably the most inspiring person I probably have ever met was my piano teacher, who at the time I didn't realize how gifted she was in what she did. when she was teaching me the piano, but she would do some pretty crazy things, or at least I thought so at the time. She was a chain smoker, and she would smoke would come out of her mouth 10 minutes after she'd finished smoking. That's how much she smoked. So I always had these images of playing the piano and this sort of fire-breathing piano teacher, Joyce Clark, sort of beside me. I would go home and literally my underpants would smell of smoke. It was that smoky. But she would do some very interesting things. Well, I think we were learning to play Moonlight Sonata, and she would teach me by getting me to ride on her hands. She would say, "Let me show you how to play this." So I'd put my hands on hers, and she'd do, "That's how you play it." I thought, that's very curious. she would be in another room and I would play and I'd hear her tone saying, "Third finger on F sharp." Thinking, how does she know? She's watching me. And she was absolutely extraordinary. I was very curious about how this rather magical person was able to see me when I wasn't there. And she taught me some great gifts, which I didn't know at the time, but she taught me how to learn. I did my grade 8 theory of music at the age of something like 11. And that's actually quite tough for that age. You had to sit in a room and for 3 hours and concentrate, which isn't my forte, and manage your nerves. And she taught me how to pass exams. I didn't realize at the time. She taught me how to structure my thinking, go from the known to the unknown, and, you know, score marks and pass exams. And that held me in good stead because I wasn't particularly studious at school or university, and I still managed to cram things in and pass. So they were all good sort of peak experiences for me. I guess less good experiences. I did like to play football, but I wasn't very fit. And I always remember the agony of being substituted at halftime. And, of course, nobody would say at the time that you're not very good at football and not very fit. I utterly hadn't made the connection that you need a physically strong, fit body to be a good football player or an athlete or a runner. It just completely wasn't there. So I'd get substituted at halftime. And, of course, the manager would be, "Great job, great job, great job." And I'd have to tell myself this story that it's okay, but clearly it wasn't quite good enough. And I remember getting, I was sprinting for the school at the time, and I got into the finals, I think, of the Surrey Championships when I was 10. Wow. This was an amazing moment in my memory. And I hadn't developed much. And I remember lining up on the start line of the 100 metres, and there's a man next to me. I mean, literally, fully grown, hairy man called Irwin, who had clearly developed way beyond what I had. And I spent about 20 seconds watching the back of this athletic man run down the track into the distance while the boy sort of stood in awe. I've always had this interesting play with, you know, the boy, the man. You know, when does the boy become a man? When does the boy play? When does the man play? So those are kind of some of my experiences. Very great, very grateful for those. Mm. And just asking that question and thinking about how they've impacted me is really thought-provoking, actually.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing that. And independent of, you know, whether we have recollections of some of the bad times or just the good times or both, we know that, and you know this as well from your coaching experience, that there are many things in our past that inform our leadership and how we show up in relationships in particular. So have you been able to sort of reflect and identify, when did you first notice whether things that were from your past, you know, were showing up in your leadership negatively, either in relationships or the way that you led, what you were doing? Did you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, so, you know, my pattern's been I use humour and comedy and distraction to diffuse conflict. That's a theme, and that probably came partly from my upbringing. My sister was very challenging for my parents, and she caused a lot of distress. And so I kind of went the other way. I would balance that distress with humour and diffusing situations by being light and playful. I then found that kind of playfulness allowed you to shine a light on issues and topics that were difficult to talk about without there being the sort of pain. So clearly I was avoiding emotional pain by being light and holding that in. And that theme of being playful and some would say irreverent continued way into my professional life, and my sort of my glass being half full. You know, I have this optimism, this belief that things are possible, that there's always a way. And I found as I became more of a leader that I could overplay that optimism. You know, I could smile at times when it seemed a smile wasn't appropriate. I could find a joke or a piece of comedy or some humor in the, you know, in some very difficult or dark moments. And that was actually a way of me channeling my intellect to be able to articulate what I could see in a way that other people could consume. But that became overplayed. So people would say, you're not taking this seriously, you know, you're being too irreverent. So particularly people who are very serious and very measured would sometimes struggle to trust me and connect me. You know, are you really who you say you are? Are you really going to do what you say you're going to do? People like you, you know, can't be trusted. So I learned I had to dial that down in life and be conscious of that. And I would often check in and see, you know, the sort of impact I was having. I remember once when I was a consultant, I did a pitch for a piece of work. I got on a train to go up to the Midlands, and the train was very, very late. And so I walked into the room. I had 14 minutes to pitch. We had a net 2 hour slot. It was just me. And so I had to go back to the roots of, this is going to be a great story one day. I had nothing to lose. And I remember walking in the room. I thought, well, the script's gone out the window. I'm going to have to improvise. And I looked in the eyes of the HR director and the CEO, and I said, look, I'll be really honest with you. You know what you're doing. You know your people. But I've done this type of thing before, and here's three things that you need to do for this to be successful. And then I left. And on the train, they literally rang me up 20 minutes later and said, we want to hire you. I was like, this is amazing. I should do 14-minute pitches. Anyway, the project was quite difficult, actually. The CEO had to communicate some very difficult news, and that actual project was quite complicated. But at the end of the project, about 2 months after, I asked Kirsty, the HR director, I said, just out of interest, why did you hire me? And she said, you were right. She said, we knew what we were doing, and we knew our people. We just knew it'd be a lot more fun if you were around.
Great. That's so nice.
So I kind of took solace from that, actually, yes, things were lighter. And you know, there's difficult times when you're a leader. I mean, leadership is fascinating because, you know, leadership is fundamentally about working with uncertainty, and uncertainty isn't fun. No. And uncertainty is lonely, and uncertainty is full of naysayers. And you've got to find light at all times if you're going to go through this sort of endurance tunnel. The chemistry
Thank
of
you
endurance
for that. And that leads me on to how else you might have adapted your leadership style as you got older. You know, to reconcile your learning, to understand that relationships were very different with different people, and as you toned down some of that lighter side when it was needed with very serious people. What else comes to mind in terms of how you to actually adapt your leadership style as you became more mature? Obviously, there's times when you're immature. I get that because the humour, but as you're becoming a bit more mature in life and years.
Yeah, so I got pretty good at that. The first trigger for adapting is, you know, emotional intelligence, isn't it? It's realising that right now what's needed is not what I'm offering up. And because I've had some experience in working with people from the performing arts, I was very interested in, you know, magicians and actors and dancers and singers, and, you know, you and watching films, you know, we have these characters in us that we're able to access. There's a moment when we need to access that authoritative part of ourselves, where we need to be able to hold space, you know, to be authoritative, to be assertive but not aggressive. Times when we need to be compassionate. You know, we need to be able to listen. We need to be able to connect. And so I had studied this. I'd studied, psychometric profiling, and realized that actually those characters were all accessible in me. I just needed to work out how to access them. And the way I learned to do that was through naming them, giving them names. And each of those characters has a physicality. It has a name, has a voice, and it has a narrative. And so I would call upon those characters at different times when I realized right now what's needing is, you know, the compassionate self and not the the magician that's going to solve things. And I learned really through embodiment to access those states, often through a thought about intent for the other person, but actually grounding in myself and taking a breath and accessing that part of me which was going to be of most service in that moment. And it took a long time to master. It's not an easy thing to do. When I used to present, I struggled to even stay still. It took me something like 2 years to stop moving. These things are so highly wired in us, that pattern of going back to, you know, inspiration and energy, this dopamine, this adrenaline that's kind of running naturally through my body has to be tapered. And I've learned, you know, I've spent 30 years really working to hone that ability to change from moment to moment. So that's kind of how I've done that. Other people will tell me if it's been successful or not.
Yeah, they'll feel that in your presence in that sense. So just building on that, and it may be similar, I don't know, but there may be something different. If you think about some of the characters that someone like Shehrzad Shamin talks about in terms of the saboteurs that appear for us in our minds, you know, whether that's the chimp or whatever it might be. But I love the saboteurs because it does characterize them and they're easy to relate to in the sense of when we're feeling that judgment, resentment, frustration, anger, which we all do as human beings. So where have you been successful or struggled in terms of managing those saboteurs so you can sustain this approach that you've been talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, the biggest saboteur, I think, is probably, you know, I'm not good enough. Mm. I think when you're leading, there's a constant, am I good enough to pull this off? You know, a lot of people are saying, really? What are you doing? That'll never work. That'll never work. And even when you think it's going to work, you say, have I got what this takes? And my personal strategy on that is reconnect with the mission, reconnect with the purpose. I mean, you know, in previous lives, I've run businesses that help people work with performance anxiety. So trying to build a business that helps people work with nerves when they speak. Mm-hmm. And when you've worked with enough people and heard the stories of people who've lived their lives on beta blockers or people that haven't, you know, managed to speak up in difficult or abusive relationships or people who want to change roles or, you know, connecting to the reason why you're doing this really overcomes things like self-doubt and am I good enough? Because, you know, we need to get this work out to people. There are people right now, like my daughters, both of my daughters left school. And, you know, a very interesting relationship with education. They left school really with no understanding of confidence, how confidence works, what confidence is. And one of them really struggles with her nerves. She's very anxious, even would struggle to go to Starbucks and order a coffee at the age of 21. So these are gifts. So when I'm struggling, saying, really? Have I really got what this takes? Is this really possible? I think about the impact that has and the stories and the change that I've seen in people when I've led things and delivered things in my life. So that's, and the second one I think is losing love. You know, we are very fearful of losing love. And as a leader, there's times when you have to do difficult things. So I've been through 4 recessions now. So when you're leading teams, you have to part company with people. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And people fall out of love with you. You know, you were the revered leader and nothing could go wrong. We all made money. We had fun in the good times. And then the difficult times come. And I think that's the same with parenting. I think I've learned some interesting lessons about parenting. The balance between being the friend of my children and the parent and father of my children. And it's not a popularity competition. So somehow being able to hold love lightly and hold self-doubt lightly and really think about the impact you're having on people is my go-to. And remembering those stories of the past and remembering that the bad times usually pass and the good times return.
Well, that builds nicely into my next question. So we've all had experience of... you know, recessions and ups and downs. So from your perspective, what do leaders need to pay attention to be able to sustain, you know, success and be effective over time?
Well, such a good question. I think I actually think it's often easier to lead when things aren't so good. You know, I've got personal experience of that, working on projects that, you know, in organizations that were very distressed. I was actually seconded into Lehman Brothers when it went bust as a sort of HR director. Well, that was an extraordinary sort of environment of instantaneous change from investment bank to insolvency without the help of any consultants in that change process in sort of 10 minutes flat. But I think when things are difficult, there's something helpful about when things are difficult for leaders, because everybody knows there's a problem and everyone's paying attention to it at the same time, particularly if it's instant. And so you have the eyes and ears of people who are looking for leadership. They're looking for somebody to take charge. They're looking for someone in that moment of uncertainty where fear is running through the veins to give them certainty. People want certainty. And so for leaders, you know, the trick is, how do you give people who are uncertain and fearful and in a state of stress and thinking about all those lower order things in Maslow's hierarchy of needs? They don't care about the vision. They want to know, have they got a job? Are they going to go home? Are they going to get paid? Is there going to be food on the table? So the question is, how do you give them certainty, even when you don't know the answers for yourself? And we see lots of examples of that at the moment where the answers aren't true. So there's some real tricks in here. The first one is, the way that you communicate with people needs to be, I found, in a sort of regular fashion. We have a heartbeat for a good reason. And if you can put some sort of structure into place where people know when they're going to hear things in a consistent sort of pattern, you kind of put a heartbeat back into a situation, into a team, into an organization. And that steadies people. That kind of steadies the nervous system. So even though they don't know the answers, they know when there might be the next interaction. The second thing I've learned is the role of oxytocin in the body and showing vulnerability. So trust is fundamentally a feeling. It's fundamentally about oxytocin in the body. And we know the science. When we show vulnerability, we generate oxytocin in ourselves and others. And that's why often you hear sort of advisors saying, you know, show more of yourself. It's okay to say you don't know the answers. I think leaders often think, I need to show up with a narrative that says, I know what we're going to do. I know how we're going to do it. It's all going to be okay. Simply follow me. There's no oxytocin in that story. There's no dopamine. So we need to generate oxytocin. So I think showing some vulnerability, that will mean saying, well, you know what? I woke up this morning and I wasn't sure what to do. I did have doubts about this business I'm leading. I did have reservations about the decisions I'm making. And I spoke to my wife this morning and we had this conversation. People will lean in. Their trust is being built instantaneously in the moment. I think that's a very important thing to do. And, you know, and getting to work with certainty. What is certain for people? Listening is obviously key. People need to be heard. They need to voice and express their fears and emotion.
Yeah, and listening with the intent to understand, as opposed to just listening to understand what I should say next. That's a big distinction.
Yeah. And listening is fundamentally transformative.
Yeah, absolutely. And bear in mind what you said, and bear in mind where we are right now, and people out there listening to this and thinking, well, there's AI and there's digital and this move's just moving so fast. How am I going to keep up with this? You know, what's your view in terms of how this modern, fast-changing digital world, is affecting leadership? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the kind of meta view of the world that everyone talks about is this perform, transform, isn't it? It's how do I build a business for the future and run the business that I have at the moment when everything's kind of constantly changing around me. And that requires a lot of agility and thinking. And that, you know, the things I've seen and around things like improvisational comedy, this ability to hold ideas lightly is an amazing skill, because what you know today doesn't seem true tomorrow. I mean, take the coaching profession, which is very close to my heart. There's never been a better time to be a coach unless you want to earn a living. The pressures on coaching at the moment, you know, coaching AI is going to be very effective at asking questions and building relationship and diagnosing and helping people. And, you know, it's used extensively in other aspects of people's performance. You know, digitization is commoditizing coaching. So, you know, there are real threats to some of our industries. And so we need to be very adaptable. We need to say, well, what do I have that digital doesn't have to offer? Which is partly why I work with the body, because it's going to struggle, actually, digital is going to struggle to diagnose breathing patterns and tension in the body in the same way, potentially, as I could, or work with your voice. So holding ideas lightly. And the research is very interesting that agility, leadership agility, is actually hugely linked to the flexibility we have in our bodies. And the more flexible we can be, in not only in the way we move, but in the sort of fascia and the tissues, interconnecting within the muscles, is actually linked to our flexibility. So staying physically fit and physically flexible is directly correlated to having a mind and an ability as a leader to embrace change, to adopt new ways of working, to be open to ideas. And the last thing I always took from improvisational comedy was the theme of status. I think when we talk about leadership a lot, we sort of talk about power, don't we? We sort of talk about power and narrative. And I think what's important, I think, to master is this ability to, when you're leading, to hold your status and raise the status of other people. I think what I see is a pattern of, I raise my status and lower yours. I know what I'm doing, and who are you to challenge my strategy? And actually, I need to do the reverse of that. And there's a lot of techniques from things like improvisational comedy that allow us to build on other people's ideas and listen in a way where people know whatever they say is going to be accepted and built upon. So they're very simple concepts in the performing arts, but they're immensely powerful in the world of business, which is why I see some consultants and coaches come in playing with yes and yes but games. And you can actually go into the chemistry of what that's doing into the body and how that releases tension, reduces cortisol, and allows people, you know, more permission to speak up. I think the bigger challenge for leaders right now is endurance. Yeah. Setting a vision out here. So we're going to decarbonize shipping. We're going to transform our business to be totally circular. And yet everything's changing. We still need to make money. Structures are changing. I don't even know if I'm going to have the same job. And so this is kind of the endurance tunnel that we're in. So people are having to be resilient. It's that term I think we're all getting a bit fed up with. We're going to just have to hang in there. But how do you pull people through the endurance tunnel? You know, leaders have to master motivation. And motivation is fundamentally about pain and pleasure. And we'd much prefer to live our lives moving towards something pleasurable, like a better world, a cleaner world, a more equitable world. But we're also very motivated by moving away from pain and pulling people through the endurance tunnel and really working with the dopaminergic system whilst people are bouncing around with huge amounts of uncertainty. Can I afford my rent? Am I going to have a job? Is this organization going to be restructured yet again? Is a real skill and a real art. And you're really playing with the chemistry of the body, endorphins, dopamine, and finding joy and really helping people reconnect with what we might achieve, what the world might be like if we fulfill this. That's a really tough challenge, for leaders, particularly, you know, in today's environment where it doesn't seem to be a day goes by where everything changes.
Thank you. And there'll be people out there listening to this, watching this, that have resonated, you know, with your story and what you're sharing. So for those people that are still listening, you know, what advice would you give to them in terms of maybe one or two pieces of advice about how they can channel, you know, whatever's happened to them in terms of leading in this environment? What comes to mind from what we've talked about today?
Yeah, I think for any leader, and, you know, with a small L, we're leading in many capacities, aren't we? We're leading in our work, but also leading in our families. I think the key thing is, there's two key things. One is to really think and take your experiences from the past and bring them into the present moment. So when you have doubt, you can actually access times in your life where you've had doubt and you've acted and things have worked out okay. Okay, these are somatic markers and memories that we have to draw upon. If we can get skillful at bringing those moments back into the present, we can actually shift our entire state, neurochemical and neurological state. So those are all of our experiences are available for us at all times, thinking of times when we've been confident, thinking of times when we've really made a difference, thinking of times where we found courage and bravery, even though we were fearful. So those are all available. So I'd always encourage people to practice finding experiences, bringing them into the present and fully embodying those so they're available. You know, I'm a big believer that in times of crisis, when you're really under pressure, the only things available to you are installed into your body. You know, it's the reason when you're cycling down the road and something awful happens and you catch it. You know, that's in you, that's in your system, it's ingrained into you. The same with all of those experiences. So find those experiences and realize they're all available to you at any time. And the second thing I'd always say is that the skill for anything in life is to be able to respond and not react. Okay, to be able to respond. And the difference between that is simply a breath. So we're often triggered into reacting. We might get angry, we might get frustrated. So if you look at some of the work of charities like the Forgiveness Project, which is all about taking the breath and having the ability to listen to the story of a perpetrator of violence or crime so that you can understand their position so that you may react differently and generate a different future. Absolutely the same in any situation. So when the kids are kicking off and it's driving you mad and you want to shout and scream and throw things, the breath is everything. Taking a breath, having the ability to change state, change neurochemistry, and that breath gives you choices. Breath gives you choices, and choices always lead to success, and reaction rarely does. And everyone can breathe because we all have a body. So taking that breath, getting into a different part of our nervous system, the one that's about communication and connection, that's part of the ventral vagus, is going to give us choices and going to give us behavioral flexibility. We lose behavioral flexibility under pressure, and we lose behavioral flexibility when we just react in the moment. It's easy to say, and it's a lifetime skill to master, but I would always recommend to people, try it in the small moments. Try it when somebody says something and they upset you, there's something in you that gets triggered. You want to react. How dare you say that about me? Take a breath and respond rather than react. I remember my first experience of doing that. When I trained as a coach, I love training as a coach because I had this amazing toolkit, and I thought maybe most coaches feel like this. You think you're magical. You can walk in a room and change people's lives. And I remember on one of my very early coaching assignments, I went to work with a doctor in a London hospital, and I was feeling super confident. I went up to the seventh floor and I said, "How can I help you?" And he said, "I have a problem." And I thought, this is great. He's got a problem. That's great. It's definitely what I need. And I said, "Yeah, tell me about your problem." And he said, "Yeah, I have a problem with one of my team." And he said, I thought, this is great. I've done this stuff with team and employees. This is going to go well. And I said, "What was the problem?" And he walked over to this window and he said, "She said I tried to murder her. She said I tried to throw her out of this window." At this moment, I had a high rise in cortisol. I was thinking, I don't remember this being the course. We did finances, we did relationships. You know, high cortisol spike, all this ethics, all sorts of things happen. And I remember thinking, you can deal with this. You can deal with this. And I remember taking a breath, thinking, I have no choice. I did really feel for him, and the work he was doing was amazing. And I remember taking a breath and thinking, something will come, something will come. And what came into my mind, I remember seeing Ruby Wax interview O.J. Simpson. And so I came up with the immortal line. I said, "Well, did you?" And he said, No, it does not open enough. And I say, where is she now? She is still in my team. This is still a problem.
Brilliant.
But he turned out to have a lovely coaching relationship and really got under the skin of what was going on. And no team members were murdered in the process, I'm pleased to report.
Good. We're coming towards the end of our time, Kevin, but I've got one last question for you, which is, we've talked a lot about your past and what's been going on for you more recently, but you know, what about the future for you? What will you be in service of in the coming years? And if people are interested in cooperating with you around that, collaborating, how can they contact you to help?
Yeah, thanks. So the big thing at the moment is bringing this term physical intelligence to the world. Physical intelligence effectively being our third intelligence. We have intelligence, emotional intelligence, and physical intelligence. And I don't think there's ever been a time in the evolution of human where we need to dig much deeper into what we naturally have available to us so that we can think more clearly and manage our confidence and motivation and really understand what this amazing human technology has to offer us. So the mission is to really get the concept out there, to get people to really put physical intelligence in the hands of coaches, in the hands of leaders. And the big project we're working on at the moment is to put physical intelligence in the hands of, you know, anybody who wants that, through developing some digital products that just let people consume the science, the research, and the performance practices. And so everyone can engage in that. You can just Google physical intelligence. You know, you can check out the Physical Intelligence Institute, and you can come to events. And what we're loving to do is collect stories of how people are using this work. So we've been working, for example, with head teachers of schools who are looking at taking this type of work into the classroom to help children be more receptive to learning or be more present if they've come from difficult family backgrounds, people taking into nursing to deal with things like burnout in nursing and a sort of lack of compassion, and people taking it all into all sorts of corporate and philanthropic settings. So that's the mission at the moment. We don't own it. Everyone has a body. We don't need lots of gurus in this space because we're all gurus, and we're trying to make this slightly esoteric but rather beautiful and very powerful world very accessible and very real and very practical, so that people can apply it to their lives and that we can all thrive through these challenging and difficult times. So that's the mission at the moment. And then at some point I'm going to write a sitcom. This is my deep mission, is to write a sitcom about coaching, because I think the tools that we learn as coaches are incredible and multifaceted, and to be able to shine some light on small things that make a big difference that people can apply in their own lives and in relationship to others, I think is a gift that we need to share more. So I'm going to do that through the power of humor. I might even appear in it as the aspirant who always wanted more and never quite got there because of their own misgivings. That's my confession.
Well, the great thing is the great thing is we started having something in common in terms of the degree that we studied, and we finished with something in common because I'm meeting my friend Nigel tonight. There's not many Nigels around now these days, and Nigel and I are also going to write a sitcom. We don't know what it's going to be yet, but we certainly enjoy being with each other and have the real, as you say, energy around each other in terms of making things funny. So I share that with you as well. Let's see how they all turn out.
I look forward to seeing that.
Absolutely. Well, Kevin, it's been a real pleasure to have you. I really appreciate you sharing your experiences with our audience. I know that many of them will have been inspired, you know, to reflect on their own leadership style and how they might actually take a different approach to both leading themselves and others in the future. I hope everyone out there enjoyed this episode of Confessions of a Successful Leader. You can find out more information about conscious leadership and self-coaching just by typing in Andrew Talents into LinkedIn or Google. Usually my name is associated with those things. And until next time, don't forget to stay present, stay curious, and above all, stay conscious. Goodbye, everyone. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Confessions of a Successful Leader. You can access all previous episodes of the show at confessionsofasuccessfulleader.com. If you are interested in finding out more about conscious leadership and self-coaching, just type in Andrew Talents into LinkedIn or your favorite browser. and you'll find my contact details and all the content that you need. Until next time, don't forget to stay present, curious, and above all, conscious.
Thank you for enjoying this content by Billionaires in Boxes. If you would like to be a guest or a host, be sure to get in contact with us at billionairesinboxes.com.